Welcome to Dev News, the news show for developers by developers, where we cover the latest in the world of tech. I'm Saranya Barak, founder of Disco.
And I'm Josh Pitts, principal engineer at Forum.
This week, we're talking about a new Apple settlement and a big win for workers in Portugal.
Then we speak with Nicolas Boucher, PhD candidate at the University of Cambridge, about new research into something they're calling a Trojan source attack.
A summary of the paper is that we found that we can encode source code files, or most programming languages, in such a way that compilers will do something different than what the developers expect.
Then we chat with Safiya Abdallah, senior software engineer at Microsoft, about new updates and features in the recently released .NET 6.
In addition to kind of being a very interesting problem to solve, which is how do you make a technology approachable to new developers, it also allowed us to like collaborate with teams all across that stack.
So you might remember last season when we talked about a class action lawsuit Apple settled with US app developers, where it paid out $100 million worth of payments to app makers and will allow app developers to promote alternative payment methods that can circumvent Apple's 30% commission of in-app purchases of digital goods and services. Now, to be fair, the alternative payment methods couldn't be in the apps, and developers would have to email users about payment methods they can use outside of the app, but still, a small victory for those app developers. Well, this week, Apple has settled another lawsuit, but this time with its own store employees. The story, which was first reported by Bloomberg, says that the company has agreed to pay out $30 million to employees who say that they were forced to stay after working hours, sometimes for as long as 45 extra minutes unpaid, to have their bags searched for potential theft before being able to leave. Apparently, Apple CEO Tim Cook was unaware of this policy until the 2013 lawsuit, and terminated in 2015. So that's interesting. I didn't know that Apple used to do that, actually.
What struck me about this particular settlement was, if you read through the fine print, it only impacts Apple retail employees in California. Everywhere else, no compensation. From what I understand, it's pretty common for retail workers to be searched upon leaving or entering their workplace. But 45 minutes, I mean, that's like they're boarding a
flight.
That's
a while.
Yeah.
That's a lunch break. That's a while. I think to me, what was surprising about this article is it felt like off-brand to me. Like, on the one hand, I totally appreciate that Apple has very expensive products that aren't huge, you know, relatively easy to steal, right? So, like, I get that just from a, you know, protecting our stores and, you know, protecting our goods, just from a purely business perspective. But when I think about the Apple brand of, like, design and creativity and expression and all that, I don't know. I guess I always felt that that extended to their store employees, where store employees were kind of part of that same family. Like, I hate using the word family in like business context, but it does feel that way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it feels like an extension of the Apple brand, and they're always very knowledgeable and super helpful. And it feels weird to frisk your brother. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
On the other hand, though, I mean, this has kind of been an ongoing theme that Apple treats its retail employees quite differently than they treat their other like non-retail employees. And they, you know, for better or worse, their retail employees are not treated as well. They're certainly not paid as well.
Right.
They don't get to work in the big spaceship in California. They're out in actual stores.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this kind of tracks. I think the disappointing parts to me is that it took a lawsuit for Apple to actually like compensate their employees. Like it just seems.
That part is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that they were kind of doing this bag check thing was very surprising to me just because it just felt very off-brand for Apple. But on top of that, not paying them felt very off-brand. Like I kind of felt like, I don't know, I guess I always had this impression, maybe it's just good marketing, that Apple generally like did the right thing and, you know, stood by its people, at least in terms of like, you know, its users, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's very like user advocate type of brand. And it's really shocking that they didn't pay for the extra time. That feels like an obvious thing to do. Like, if you're going to make me stay at work for whatever reason, then you should be paid for that.
Yeah.
So it's surprising that that took a lawsuit to fix.
Yeah, I agree with that. On the other hand, though, I do just kind of feel like we've definitely seen cracks in Apple's facade in terms mm-hmm. of how they treat their employees, how they treat their customers, how they treat developers. Their marketing team is incredible. Like, their advertising and their branding is incredible. But I think we're seeing more and more that they're just a large company like any other large company. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, they're looking out for their profits.
They're beholden to their shareholders. Yes. At the end of the day, that's really what it's all for. Well, anyways, good for the employees who got their money. And I mean, it's great that they're no longer doing this. So that also kind of was surprising to me that Tim Cook found out about it in 2013, but it still took 2 years to stop it, which I don't know what that was about. But
yeah, that part's pretty disappointing. I know a CEO is not going to be privy to every single little micro issue and policy happening. But to your point, where Tim Cook is going on television and he's telling people that they believe in their employees and they care about their customers. And like, for that person then to know about this policy and not like immediately try to like have someone look into it, that part feels really bad as well.
Yeah, that doesn't feel great.
Well, next we have another story that's a big win for employees. The Portuguese government passed legislation banning employers from contacting their staff outside of business hours, as well as monitoring their work remotely. If employers contact their employees outside of their contracted working hours, they can be fined unless it's deemed an emergency. Remote employees are also required to go into physical workplaces to meet with supervisors and build community with their fellow employees so they don't suffer too much isolation. The move is an effort to not only protect workers from working outside of their contracted working hours, but to promote Portugal as a destination to work remotely. Ana Mendes Godinho, Portuguese labor minister, said while presenting the new legislation, quote, "We consider Portugal one of the best places in the world for these digital nomads and remote workers to choose to live, and we want to attract them to Portugal," end quote. This is some really interesting legislation. What do you think about this, Ron?
Yeah. So I'm totally down for the no contact after work hours. I think it totally makes sense. I think that's very respectful of boundaries. And it takes the burden off of the employee to set the boundary.
Yes.
Because it's like, well, it's not me. Like, the government said you can't call me. Like, I would love to hear from you. But ultimately, the government said no. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it kind of sets up that boundary, which is really nice. But in terms of trying to be a place to attract digital nomads, the whole required to go to a physical workplace, I feel like totally kills that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, if I'm working in America, but, you know, I want to be digitally nomadic and I want to move to Portugal, obviously that's not going to work because I need to have an office to go into. So I didn't get that part.
Yeah, that part is really strange to me, where on the one hand, they're saying have less contact with your employees, you know, for better or for worse. But on the other hand, they're saying bring them on in. It almost feels like maybe this was a concession to physical employers that were kind of like, oh, we don't love this.
It feels like a concession. I think that's right.
Yeah, that part's really strange. So the other part that struck me about this law was that employers could be fined for contacting their employees outside of work hours. I'm really curious, who reports that and how does that get enforced?
Right. Is there like a hotline or something where you just send screenshots of text and you're like, look what happened. Like this dude... 9:45 p.m., man. Look what he's up to.
You share your Slack
message. Find him $100.
Yeah.
Yeah.
share to channel government report and then just...
Yes.
Yeah, that's crazy to me. I really wonder how this law gets enforced, especially because the company's not going to self-report it. It would have to be the employee that's reporting this. And then it's going to be pretty obvious who's reporting it. So is there going to be backlash?
Right. It feels like a backlash situation. Like, it feels like you would need some courage to actually do the reporting.
I love the idea, though, that Portugal is like, hey, digital nomads, come work here. We want to attract you. I think that's a really cool idea. I've known several people that have worked remotely abroad and chosen Portugal for its lovely climate and friendly people and low cost of living. It seems really interesting to me. I wonder if we'll see other countries attempt to court remote workers and digital nomads with laws like this.
I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the, you know, not full in office, but requiring 1 or 2 days a week as part of the remote, you know, deal, the remote setup? How do you feel about that as a stipulation?
Well, I will say off the bat, I am a completely remote worker. So any kind of like, you must go into the office is like, ooh, I don't love it.
Yeah.
I find that it has the opposite effect, right? We want to attract digital nomads. We want to attract remote workers. But then having that in-work requirement part makes it so you have to cluster workers in physical locations.
Exactly.
It doesn't say what office they have to go to. Maybe it's just an office. It's a little unclear from the way the law is written and the research we've done if they have to go to like their home office, if they just go to a office anywhere with another employee. It's a little unclear, but that I thought that part really kind of killed the other part of the law that was trying to encourage remote working.
Exactly, 100%. I feel like the biggest benefit of remote working is that you can live anywhere you want. Mm-hmm. You can live halfway across the country. You can live in another country. You can literally be wherever you want and still have, you know, the job that you want and work for the company that you want to work for. And the moment that any type of in-person requirement, you know, shows up, you lost that freedom. And that's like the biggest advantage of working remotely. So
yeah,
I feel like, I mean, obviously having, you know, some flexibility is good, but if it's not fully remote, I feel like you lose the biggest benefit of being remote, and any type of, you know, in-person requirement just kind of undoes all that.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like the way, like reading through the rest of the law, there's another provision of this law that it gives young parents the right to work from home without having to get approval from their boss as long as their child is less than 8 years old, which is fantastic.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I've overall read this law as it seemed like it was pitched to companies that might not have a lot of remote work going on right now, or a lot of like, you know, like to try to push them into being more remote friendly. And I wonder if you're a fully remote company, there might be some exceptions to the in-person work requirements. But reading through the rest of this, it's not so much, it's interesting that the labor minister of Portugal brought up attracting foreign workers, you know, and making Portugal a digital nomad destination when the rest of the law is really around work-life balance. It's not really around, you know, remote work. If they were targeting remote workers, I'd expect to see things in this law like you could use your home country's tax rate or, you know, things like that. Or we'll give you a longer visa if you're remote working in Portugal. Mm-hmm. And there's none of that in here. So I think this law is just overall pitched at in-person companies and to try to encourage them to do remote work or do work from home, but maintain work-life balance.
Yep, absolutely. Coming up next, we talk about a new kind of hack researchers are calling a Trojan source attack. After this. Here with us is Nicolas Boucher, PhD candidate at the University of Cambridge and author of the research paper, Trojan Source, Invisible Vulnerabilities. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about what this paper is and how you started looking into this research.
A summary of the paper is that we found that we can encode source code files, or most programming languages, in such a way that compilers will do something different than what the developers expect. And what this means is if you're clever about how you do these text encodings, you can write up some software and you can sneak some kind of a bug or a vulnerability or a backdoor into the code. And you can do so in such a way that a developer who's reviewing the code will very likely not realize that that vulnerability is there. The way that we stumbled across this research is some of my research partners and I here at Cambridge and also with some collaborators in the University of Toronto in Canada had been looking into natural language processing systems. And we became interested in the idea of crafting adversarial examples, the inputs to machine learning systems that cause them to do things that you would not expect them to do. And what we had seen is that in text-based machine learning systems, adversarial examples were traditionally created by doing techniques like misspelling words and things like this. And you can have some interesting enough results, but we thought it would be really cool if there was a way to create these adversarial examples in a way that wasn't so visible to humans. And what we had stumbled across was that we could use strange text encodings, things within, say, the Unicode text specification, that were a little bit less standard, but perfectly valid according to how we are allowed to encode text. And we saw that we could have things like toxic content classifiers and machine translation and a whole bunch of other machine learning, natural language processing tasks just completely fall over when we presented them these strange encodings. We started thinking about it and we said, well, what more could we do with these encodings? And we quickly stumbled across the idea that, well, hey, we could probably do some cool stuff with compilers, with interpreters, with source code in general, and see if we can do some kind of evil things. And well, what we ended up stumbling across was the Trojan Source paper.
I'm curious, are there similar types of attacks to the Trojan Source attack that have been used by hackers in the past?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer explicitly, because certainly there's all sorts of stuff that's out there that we just might not know about if it's not, say, public on GitHub. But there are concrete examples that I can give of similar techniques that have been used in, you know, slightly different settings, or in some cases, some very similar settings. So to me, the most interesting example is this attack that we saw some reporting on in the wild on the Ethereum blockchain, specifically with smart contracts. And what we saw was that apparently there have been bidirectional override characters used to switch the sender and the receiver of, say, payments in smart contracts out in the wild. And the way we came across this is we're actually doing some scanning on GitHub to see if we could find any evidence of these attacks being exploited in the wild. And what we found was actually a set of kind of static code checkers that were looking for switching the order of arguments on Ethereum smart contracts. And, you know, that is a certainly similar technique to what we're proposing. I mean, arguably, it's very similar in terms of one aspect of what you can do, which is switching the order of arguments. In the Trojan Source paper, our proposal is that you can do a lot more than just switching arguments. You can cause comparisons to fail. You can inject lines of code that look like they're not there because they look like they're comments. You could, for example, cause a function to return early before it actually executes the logic that a developer may expect. So I think the short answer to your question is, yes, there are versions of this that have been used in the wild. There are versions of this that have been written about in non-academic contexts. But what we believe we're presenting is kind of a somewhat more comprehensive overview of what we believe are a potentially very devastating set of attacks.
Tell me more about how these Trojan Source attacks are novel compared to other kinds of, you know, the attacks that you just talked about, similar attacks.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, right off the top, the most straightforward thing is, to our knowledge, there's no academic work that describes any of these other variants of the attack that I was just talking about. Mm-hmm. In terms of how ours is different from that, so to be very explicit, the examples that we found were taking two arguments to functions and using bidirectional override characters to swap the order of those two arguments. Now, in most of the examples that we found, these arguments, based on the techniques that were used, could only be, you know, variables that were a single character, you know, like a variable named A or B or something like this. And in the right setting, you could cause those to be displayed in an order that was reversed from what they actually were. Now, that setting was very specific. It required comments to be kind of within the function call parentheses and some things like this that looked a little bit perhaps unnatural, but certainly used bidirectional overrides to cause problems. In our attacks, we propose three different general techniques. So one of those techniques is we take comments and we make them look like code, or we take code and we make them look like comments by taking bidirectional override characters and embedding them in comments on the same line as some real code. We have a similar technique where we do this within strings. So the idea is that if I have a string literal, I can inject a right-to-left override or a left-to-right override, depending on the setting, or a combination thereof. And I can make that string, you know, at the encoding level, contain these control characters. But at the visualization level, I can take things that are within the string and make them look as if they're actually code that's being executed, which is not the case when that code gets to the compiler. So, you know, in short, I think the difference between what we found in the wild and what we're talking about in the paper is just in the breadth of what you can do. You know, whether you want to cause some code that's there to look like it's not there, whether you want to cause code that's not there to look like it's there, or whether you want some function to short circuit altogether. These are the techniques that we're offering in the Trojan Source paper, but we certainly want to give credit to a variety of, you know, security researchers, you know, primarily in the wild, that have used bidirectional overrides to swap the order of arguments.
Would you consider this attack vector an issue with Unicode? Is it an issue with compilers and their handling of Unicode, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I don't know that there's a straightforward answer to it. So I'll give the methodology I've been used to approach this. So, you know, compilers often implement a formal language specification, not in every case, but often, you know, there is some formal document describing what a proper language is supposed to do. And, you know, for languages that have formal specifications, you can argue that the language specification is where you might want to protect against something like this by saying that, hey, these directionality override characters can actually be pretty dangerous. And we, you know, we might want to forbid them to be used in certain contexts. And then you would expect that compilers would implement that behavior downstream. You know, but the challenge there is not every language has a formal specification. Maybe those changes take a long time to happen. Maybe it's not agreed upon by the spec maintainers that that's desirable. So, you know, then you have this next step in the pipeline, which is compilers and interpreters can do things like throw compiler warnings if they detect the presence of potential attacks like this. And, you know, I think a great example of a defense that's been really well built in that regard is the Rust compiler. The Rust team was a group that we sent a disclosure to as we were doing this research, and they did a really good job, in my opinion, of having thorough, verbose warnings that they throw when this specific attack pattern is detected. But, you know, the reality there, too, is not every compiler or interpreter is going to see this as their issue to fix, and that's fine. I wouldn't necessarily agree, but, you know, there are other places you can protect against this, and perhaps one of the most impactful overall would be static code scanners, because, you know, if we have high value production code that's being deployed somewhere, we would hope that there is some sort of static code scanning that's going on. And I think that takes a lot of different forms, but doing a check for bidirectionality overrides is a relatively straightforward thing I would expect for most static code scanners to be able to add functionality for. And what I would finish with is to say that there are those that would look at this and say, you know, this might not be a compiler or interpreter or static code scanner problem whatsoever. This has to do with the visualization of text. And if it's about the visualization of text, then naturally any mitigations against this should be in text rendering systems. And people who take this viewpoint would argue that when we have development environments and text editors and things like code repository front ends that store our Git repos online, you know, these are places where we could work to visualize those directionality override characters in some way. Mm. And just making those visible would hopefully mitigate this attack in some way. But my personal viewpoint would be to say that every one of those defenses is valid. And whether this is a vulnerability in Unicode is perhaps, you know, depending on the context. But if we defend at every layer in the pipeline, we're more likely to be able to pick up on these attacks when they happen, rather than saying that only, you know, one in five compilers, just to make up some numbers, have fixes in them. If we say that one in five of each of these parts in the pipeline have a fix, then it's much more likely that if there is an attack, it will be detected.
So tell me more about the dangers of an attack like this. How big could the impact be?
You know, I think what's really scary about these potential attacks are that in the right setting, they're not visible. That's how we titled the paper and the probably key message we're trying to get across here. And, you know, if you have employees at a big tech company or the producers of some big product that all share common toolkits, common development pipelines and things like this, and you as an attacker have knowledge of the tools that they're using, you can most certainly craft these attacks targeting that particular tool chain if there aren't mitigations in place. And I think it is entirely plausible that you could deceive a whole group of code reviewers into thinking that something, one of these attacks, is not present. And where that gets really scary is if you had, say, an insider at one of these companies. Well, now that gives you a realistic attack vector where you can use that insider to put code in that is not very likely to get seen by someone else. And that gets incredibly scary within the context of supply chain attacks. That gets scary within, you know, key pieces of software that are utilized across the ecosystem. Off the top of my head, something like the recent SolarWinds attacks come to mind. And certainly the SolarWinds attacks weren't related to Trojan Source in any way, to my knowledge. But the point being that when you compromise something that is upstream and used across the ecosystem, which could certainly be possible with these invisible vulnerabilities, well, you know, the consequences can be absolutely immense. And that is what potentially scares me, is an invisible attack that goes undetected for quite some time on some large upstream dependency.
Can you walk us through, like, you know, soup to nuts, what a person would have to do to implement this attack? We've been talking about comments related to the bidirectional nature of some Unicode strings. Is it embedding code inside of a Unicode string and then injecting into a source code base? I'm just wondering if you could talk us through, like, the specifics of if I wanted to implement this attack.
So if you sat down at your workstation today and decided that you wanted to implement this attack, what you would need to do is come up with some sort of a method for generating these control sequences that change the order of text in Unicode. It doesn't have to be Unicode, but Unicode is probably our most common text standard that is generally accepted by most compilers and interpreters. So let's say that it's Unicode. So, you know, what would you probably do? You would probably pick your scripting language of choice, let's say Python. And you would know that in Python, there are escape sequences that you can use that will generate control characters that are otherwise invisible. And then you would take the program that you are hoping to, you know, craft an exploit into. And, you know, maybe you just have a print statement in Python or something along those lines that prints out that source code. But then you modify that source code to shift around the order of the tokens on any given line of code. And then you use the escape sequences that generate control characters to inject, say, right to left overrides into that line of code. You can think of it in some ways as conceptually similar to like a SQL injection attack. The idea that you're putting in some characters that, you know, aren't necessarily expected, and you're doing so in a way that is more or less syntactically valid in the setting that you're using them in. And it causes some unintended consequences to happen. And, you know, in this particular case, I would say you would probably be injecting these right to left override characters, assuming you're writing code that looks like English that's normally left to right. You would probably use a sequence of right to left overrides and left to right overrides, and you would put them into string literals if you had string literals in the code, or you would put them into comments, maybe multi-line comments, for example. And you would use those to be able to swap around the display order of tokens on that line of code. And ultimately what you're doing is you're saying that, you know, if program A is the source code that is seen by the compiler, it is the logically encoded order of the tokens in the source code, you're anagramming that with control characters into program B, which is not the actual logic, but it's what you want the developer, the code reviewer, to see. And then when they render that in their text editor or web editor or, you know, whatever they want in their environment of choice, they're going to see the anagrammed version, most likely, and not the logically encoded version due to those control characters you injected.
And because you're basically flipping this around and there's no real visualization of that, unless you're specifically looking for this attack vector, you're not really going to catch it, right?
Yeah, that's the fear. You know, there's some caveats to put in there that I think are important. And that's to say that this is definitely dependent upon the setting that you're in. So, for example, there are some text editors that presumably as a security measure just don't use control characters. As in, if you put a control character in the code, it'll display the code point, the number representing the control character, instead of doing the thing that that control character would normally cause a text display engine to do. Now, that being said, from our testing right now, that's certainly the minority of code editors that we've seen. And, you know, if you take maybe one example of a vulnerable code editor is VS Code. And in VS Code, if you have some text that has control characters in it, at least as of right now, it will use those control characters. If it says to do a right to left embedding or right to left override, it will swap the order of the characters and not show you that invisible control character. And, you know, that is the setting that we're worried about here.
So given that this type of attack is invisible, really hard to detect, what can we do, if anything, to defend against it or potentially even block these attacks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the silver linings here is that this attack is actually pretty easy to defend against. And if you know what you're looking for, it's actually pretty easy to spot too. But the trick is you have to know what you're looking for. And that's why we're hoping to spread the word on this particular attack vector. So the easiest thing is if you see directionality override characters or these bidirectional Unicode sequences in code, that's a red flag that something could be off. Now, it's not a guarantee that there's a problem. There's all sorts of legitimate reasons that you might want to change the display order of text. Like, for example, if you are a developer who writes in both English and Hebrew, for example, well, that means you write in both a left-to-right and a right-to-left language. And if you decide that you want to change the order that sequences are displayed when you are mixing those two languages, you might have a text editor that injects some of these characters. So that is to say that simply seeing that there are directionality override characters in source code isn't a guarantee that there's a problem. But that being said, having looked through, well, actually the entirety of public GitHub, all commits that were committed to GitHub in 2021 thus far, I can tell you that there's actually not all that much of these directionality override characters in practice. But that being said, if you want to narrow this group down even more, you can say that every directionality override character normally has a closing character. So if you turn on a right to left override, you can turn off that right to left override when you're finished with it, so to speak. And the nature of this attack, to our knowledge, is only possible if you do not properly close that directionality override sequence once you open it. So the real trick here is if we have, say, a string literal that contains a directionality override, if I start overriding the direction in the string literal and I don't close that directionality override before the end of the string literal, it means that it's going to affect the code, the display of the code next to that literal. However, if I am to terminate that override sequence by having a, you know, turn off override character within the same string literal, well, that means the effect of that reordering is contained within the string, and it actually doesn't cause a security vulnerability in relation to Trojan source, at least that we're aware of. So all of that in summary is to say, if you want to protect against this attack, you should look for unterminated directionality override characters in any Unicode encoded source code file. And if you find them, you should double check that the logically encoded version of that source code is indeed what you expect it to be. You can do that by just looking at the raw bytes that are used to encode that source code. And with any luck, we'll see more and more code scanning tools picking up and warning when they see these potential, you know, indicators of attack. And I'll also say that we have seen a number of compilers and interpreters starting to throw warnings and errors for this sorts of stuff. We've also seen that shortly after we released the paper, GitHub started putting a warning banner on top of any code that contains these directionality override characters. So these are really great ways to be able to tip you off to say, there might be something wrong here, which is not a guarantee, but you should look closely at this line.
So your paper does point out this is a theoretical attack, and I'm wondering if there's any sense you have of the likelihood of someone actually exploiting something like this.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's a hard one to answer. You know,
right. Well,
so I can tell you what I don't think will happen and what I think might happen, but it's only my personal opinion. So, you know, what I don't think is going to happen is that all of a sudden we're going to start seeing millions and millions of people trying to use these control characters to sneak stuff into lots of repositories like the Linux kernel or something like that and finding success. Because I think that at this point, there are enough compilers and enough people and enough mitigations like GitHub's warning banner that will tip off someone somewhere to say, we should look closely at that line of code. That's still a potential threat vector, but I don't think that we're going to start seeing these large, massive attacks on, say, the open source ecosystem right now. What worries me more is that scenario where you have, say, a company that maintains some private code base where there's, say, an insider threat at that company, or there's maybe some kind of advanced persistent threat actor that has the ability to introduce code into a pipeline within that company in some way. You know, that's a hard thing for us to be able to measure to say how likely that is or where it's possible. But, you know, intuitively, there certainly are threats that are, you know, very well funded. There are threats that are, you know, very active and persistent in different ways. And if you have the patience and you have the time and you have the resources, what this does is it gives you a tool to be able to say, here's a vulnerability that you can't see, at least in the right setting. And I think that there is a very real possibility that we see some of these larger, more powerful adversaries use these in very targeted ways as another tool in their toolkit.
Is there anything else that we haven't covered yet that you want to talk about?
You know, there's actually one other thing I'll point out, which is an interesting thing we stumbled across in this research, and that's the nuances of coordinated vulnerability disclosure. Mm. You know, when we started this research, we thought that the entirety of the contributions of this particular piece of work would be to try and point out and say, here's something we think is a vulnerability, and here's a taxonomy you can use to think about it, and we're interested to see if anyone can think of any other cool tricks that we can use like this. You know, but then we started realizing, you know, we don't just want to take this vulnerability and throw it out there and, you know, see how many unmitigated systems are attacked on day zero. You know, we want to go through the responsible disclosure process and notify at the very least all of the compilers and the web front ends that we know are affected from our own testing. And that's precisely what we did. But the interesting thing was, this vulnerability, it really affects a lot of stuff. It affects pretty much every compiler and interpreter that we tested. It affects a very large number of code editors and websites and things like this. And, you know, we did our best to notify as many as we could. And it put us in this interesting scenario where we felt like we were trying to send disclosures across the entire industry. And it was a really interesting experience. Like, there are all sorts of things that we as researchers just hadn't considered before. Like, for example, if there is a compiler that is open source and has lots of contributors, but doesn't happen to have a dedicated security team that's willing to receive an embargoed disclosure, how are you supposed to notify them so that they can prepare a mitigation before the attack is public? That's a genuinely tough position to be in. And, you know, that's one example. There's probably dozens of scenarios like that we came across. And we talk about that a little bit in the results of the paper, and I expect that we will be writing about that more in the future.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Coming up next, we get into the details of the newly released .NET 6 after this. Here with us is Safia Abdallah, Senior Software Engineer at Microsoft. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about your role at Microsoft and what you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
I work in an organization known as the Developer Division. And as the name might suggest, this organization is kind of responsible for building a lot of the developer-focused tooling and projects that come out of Microsoft. This includes things like TypeScript, VS Code, .NET, which is kind of the sub-team that I'm a part of, and in particular, ASP.NET, which is a web framework built on top of .NET. So a lot of my day-to-day work involves working on ASP.NET. .NET, both the runtime, and ASP.NET, the web framework, and a lot of other technologies in the .NET ecosystem are actually open source. And that was one of my big motivations for moving to this team, was I wanted to kind of work in a code base and just in a project that was open source, had a lot of community engagement and involvement. That's kind of where I'm at home. Mm. My day-to-day is surprisingly being on GitHub a lot, interacting with customers on issue, reviewing PRs from my team and from community contributors. So I think what's really fun about the work that I do at the moment is that when I squint, I don't really see a big difference between the open source work that I've done in the past with other open source communities I've been involved in, and then what I do on a day-to-day basis with ASP.NET. Obviously, there's some differences because each project is unique, but the same philosophies around openness, community engagement, learning and teaching with each other in the public apply in both scenarios.
So what is the current state of .NET? Where does it stand in the world of software and the world of tech?
So .NET in and of itself, at its core, is a runtime that is capable of executing code. The primary programming language that people interact with when they're writing code that is going to run on the .NET runtime is C#. That being said, it's actually possible to write code in a variety of other languages, F# being one of them, Python is another, and even Ruby that can be compiled down to bytecode or intermediary code that runs on the .NET runtime. So you have the .NET runtime, you have the C# programming language, you have an ecosystem of tooling primarily in Visual Studio to help developers kind of be productive with .NET, IntelliSense, autocomplete, refactoring, all of that fun stuff that helps us write clean, good code. So yeah, runtime, language, the ecosystem of tooling. And I think there's another layer to that stack, which is all of the frameworks that are built on top of the .NET ecosystem. And that includes ASP.NET, which is the web framework. Another one that comes to mind is EF Core, which is kind of a data layer framework. So that's kind of how I think about the .NET ecosystem at large.
Can you tell us what your role was in this new .NET release?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I am part of the ASP.NET team. We had a lot of fun working on some interesting stuff for this, what we call it's our .NET 6 release, which shipped the second week of November, I believe. When you're actually working on a product, release dates and shipping, just like they're all a blur in your head because you're so in the energy of it all. But I worked on a couple of interesting technologies. I think one of the kind of funner ones, or the ones that I'm excited to push forward, is something called minimal APIs, which is essentially a approach for simplifying the getting started experience for building web APIs with .NET. Some of the feedback we've gotten in the past from people who are trying to get started building web apps with .NET is that there's a lot of ceremony involved. And as a new developer or someone just trying to get something out quickly, there's a lot of stuff you have to set up and learn. And so we really honed in on creating a minimal, as the name might suggest, experience that's a lot more beginner friendly. A lot of the ceremony has been removed. We've tried to introduce sensible defaults and helpful behavior that allows developers to write less code and get the same results. So that was a really interesting project to work on. I think what was great about it is some of the functionality actually spanned multiple teams. So we were leveraging new syntax that had to be changed in the C# language so that we can kind of allow people to write code that was a lot cleaner and simpler. So it was, in addition to kind of being a very interesting problem to solve, which is how do you make a technology approachable to new developers, it also allowed us to like collaborate with teams all across that stack that I was kind of describing earlier.
What are some of the biggest new features and updates in version 6?
Yeah, so I would say one of the first set of features that have been introduced in .NET 6 is around the C# language. The team has invested a lot of time in improving certain aspects of language. So for example, simplifying how users work with namespaces. Namespaces are kind of scopes that are identified for certain APIs within a .NET application. So they've improved ways in which people can identify what namespace a particular source file or code in a source file belongs to, and what namespaces are referenced in a particular project. And a couple of other fun tweaks to the C# language itself. So I think what's really cool about every release that we do with when I've been on .NET 5 and .NET 6 is that there's always a change to the C# language itself. And as a bit of a programming language geek, I always think those are really interesting and fun to observe. The other change that I think is really compelling is in a product that I have worked on in the past, which is called Blazor WebAssembly. It's a front-end UI technology that's built in .NET. I think one of the interesting things about it is it sits in the same sphere of front-end technologies like React and Vue and Angular, but it's built entirely on top of .NET technologies. And what actually happens is you write C# code, and it's going to run in a .NET runtime that's running on WebAssembly in the browser. So as part of that work, some of the interesting things that have been done for .NET 6 is support for ahead-of-time compilation for Blazor WebAssembly apps, which, without getting into too much of the nitty-gritty details, essentially allows you to take a .NET application and compile it directly down to WebAssembly bytecode and then run that WebAssembly bytecode in the browser. And the benefit of that is that users get dramatic performance improvements for code that's running in the browser. I think that technology is really compelling because moving forward, I think we want to exist in a universe where the web, and particularly front ends, are not just limited to JavaScript, and people can think and reason and build with Python, C#, Ruby, what have you. And WebAssembly is a great avenue for that to happen and just improves accessibility for the web overall, technological accessibility, I should say. Mm-hmm. And then last but not least, I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention minimal as one of the new features that I'm really excited about for .NET 6. you know, obviously I've worked on parts of it, but I think it's a really fun technology to build, because as a framework designer, you kind of have to think about, what are the friction points for people who are getting started? How can I make something a little bit simpler, more straightforward to use? And those are always the most interesting kind of technical challenges to answer as a framework developer. And I think it's cool that we were able to ship out something really great in .NET 6 and kind of keep refining it moving forward.
What were some of the biggest challenges you and your team came across while building .NET 6?
The challenges we experienced don't differ a lot from what other engineering teams experience on a day-to-day basis, which I think is kind of understanding what the problems that you need to solve are. So for example, you know, I mentioned earlier, it's all open source. We get feedback from users primarily via issues on GitHub. And a big part of it is kind of looking through all of the issues, understanding what the priorities are for different things, what problems are worth solving, what bugs are worth fixing. And that's, I think, as a developer, is always the delicate balance of knowing not just how to fix something or when to ship it, but what to work on and why to work on it. I think those are always challenging because, you know, sometimes you have a little bit of FOMO of, oh, should we have actually worked on that feature, fixed that bug? Was it more important than we thought? Or, oh, maybe we spent too much time thinking about this particular feature. And it actually turns out, you know, it wasn't important to invest that much time in it because it's not as important. So I think that delicate balance of figuring out what to focus your energy on has been the most challenging, particularly when rolling out some of the new features.
Was there anything in this release that you were hoping would be there but didn't quite make it?
More bug fixes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I've arrived at that point in my engineering career where I have stopped being interested in shiny new features. So I was like, man, if we just fix that bug that's been in the backlog, that it's, you know, it affects a certain number of people and it's got a decent enough priority, but it's always been in the backlog. I could fix all of them with one snap of my finger, I would. But I think, you know, those things are really important because that's where the quality and the consistency in any product comes in. And I think it's a lot easier to ship new features sometimes than to look at the past and all of the bugs that have accumulated and address those. So I wish we'd fix more bugs. I really do.
Can you give us a hint at some of the things that might be coming down the pipeline with future releases of .NET?
Yes, with minimal APIs, we're going to continue to improve and polish that experience. I know one of the things that I'm really excited to be working on personally is improving open API integration with minimal APIs. Open API is a schema/convention for documenting an API. So you can kind of outline what certain endpoints do, the requests that they accept, the responses they return. And we want to kind of improve integration between those two technologies. As for like what our plans are overall, one of the things that I think is really cool about working on ASP.NET is it's open source. So if people are curious to see what we're working on, you can actually go on our GitHub repo and click issues. And we've got it documented what all of our different labels and milestones mean. So if you want to see, hey, what are we going to be working on for .NET 7 preview 1? You can find all of the items that are labeled that way and kind of follow along with the team as we're building things. So I think that's a really interesting and fun aspect of working in open source is you can really follow us along as we build .NET 7 onward.
Is there anything that we didn't cover that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I think another thing that I would remind everyone listening that ASP.NET is open source and we're always looking for people to help get started contributing. Definitely one of the things that I've personally focused on is identifying ways that we can improve our new contributor experience, either by improving our build documentation, making it easier to use things like GitHub code spaces to get started contributing to the repo, and a variety of other things. So in addition to following us along as we build the future, you can actually help build it yourself, which I think is pretty cool. And something that I always like to remind people is you can kind of be a part of the technology as much as you are a user.
Well, thank you so much, Safia, for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank Thank you for listening to Dev News. This show is produced and mixed by Levi Sharp. Editorial oversight is provided by Peter Frank, Ben Halpern, and Jess Lee. Our theme music is by Dan Powell. If you have any questions or comments, dial into our Google Voice at +1 929 500 1513 or email us at pod@dev.to. Please rate and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts.